Support for WPR comes from Mashup Americans, producers of the podcast To See Each Other, about a small Wisconsin town's fight to save its last public nursing home and the ensuing statewide battle. More at toseeeachother.org.
Support for WPR comes from the Woodson Art Museum in Wausau with the 2024 Birds and Art Exhibition. Avian-themed artwork by 107 artists through December 1st. LYWAM.org.
Great to have you with us on WPR News. Larry Mueller here. You know, a single cow can produce between 154 to 264 pounds of methane gas per year. At least that's according to the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency. And there's some new technology being tested in Wisconsin that may tell us more about the methane our local herds are burping up. Joined today by Ryan Prawley, an assistant professor of animal, dairy, and veterinary sciences in the UW-Platteville School of Agriculture. And as we talk with Ryan, I hope you'll join in. He's doing some work in this area. What do you want to know about the effect of greenhouse gases produced by livestock? Do you wonder if changing the diets of cows could reduce emissions? Give us a call. The number's 800-642-1234. It's 1-800-642-1234. Or send an email to talk@wpr.org. Ryan Prawley, welcome. Thank you for taking time to be with us today.
Hi, Larry. Thank you so much for inviting me. It's a pleasure to be here.
UW-Platteville, we're testing some new technology that analyzes emissions from individual cows. And so what's the overall purpose of this technology?
So we received a grant from the USDA, a capacity building grant, where we purchased a green box. It's called a green feed. I affectionately call it a burp box. And the purpose of this box is we set it up in the corner of our research pen at Pioneer Farm. And cows visit it a couple times a day. And when they do their visit, they get a treat. And while they're munching on their treat, they emit gas from their mouth. So we get to voluntarily measure gas emissions from our 50 cows living in our research pen at Pioneer Farm. So we can monitor their daily emissions.
That is so cool. I was trying to think how it was possible to do this. Before I read up on it a little bit, I was envisioning something over the cow's head or whatever to sort of capture, but this green machine can do it.
Oh, yeah. So we really are starting to take advantage of the behavior of animals or drives to have snacks, just like people do, and entice them with these little treats. It's a few cups of pellets that get dropped, and they stand, take their meal. We have some fans that pull in the gases into the machine, and built right in the machine, we have all of our analyzers, so we can get actually four different gas measurements. Of course, the one most people are interested is methane, but we also get CO2, oxygen, and hydrogen gas on that machine.
If I'm not mistaken, you can also, you know which cow is emitting a particular emission.
Yeah. So when they walk right up, they have a little ear tag that uses RFID technology. So the machine can recognize the cow. It can, using the computer monitoring, it can tell when was her last visit, how much she ate. We can program it so that we make her have to space out her visits, so we're not having a bunch of visits right in a row and we get a sample across the day. We can limit how many times they visit, et cetera. It's really cool. And as you mentioned, Larry, it logs the cow number with the emissions that we're monitoring at that visit.
So how are farmers, or how can the, you know, now you have this information, or you will be collecting certainly probably a whole lot more. Mm-hmm. As you, but how's that information, how can it be used by farmers?
So right now, what we're trying to do at UW-Platteville is we're starting to monitor it so we can start innovating how we can manage this information. So through my research, where we're specifically interested in managing the nutrition and management of cows in a voluntary milking system or robotic milking system, see how what we change at the robot or how what we change at the feed bunk changes their emission potential. And then we can use that information to inform dairy management for our stakeholders so that they can reduce emissions. And in the future, it might be possible, or and it is with how convenient this burp box is, but farmers could invest or programs could invest in monitoring burps on individual farms. And I think one of the very interesting and big pushes is coupled with genomic technology, using this for selective mating, breeding programs, where we can pick greener cows, which is a fun initiative spearheaded at the University of Wisconsin-Madison.
Really interesting. Courtney in Barneveld has a comment for us. Let's go there. Courtney, hi.
Hi. Yeah, I want to ask about, if Ryan has any comments about the difference between, you know, there's, of course, factory farm type cows, and there's mob grazing or intense rotational grazing, which really offsets the methane issue and also can fix so much carbon in our soils. I don't hear a lot of people talking about that. One good resource is Alan Savory's TED Talk. Another good resource is a book called Cows Save the Planet, which talks about the mechanism of carbon fixation in the soil.
Courtney, thanks. Comment, Ryan.
Yeah, I definitely think there's a lot of room to start monitoring, not only in an intensive system like we have at Platteville, but also extensive systems like pasture or mob grazing operations. And with this type of technology and the work that we're starting to do here, and hopefully with stakeholders in our region, we can start monitoring and evaluating those practices and putting numbers to it.
Yeah. John in Bluff Siding, Wisconsin, your turn. Hi, John.
Hi, how's it going today?
Good, appreciate the call.
Hey, my question today is, and I think I heard the information actually on your show some time ago, is just wondering what the science was between if we switch their diet from stop feeding them so much grain and letting them eat more grass, if that would actually reduce their burps.
Yeah.
So they can produce more total gases volume when eating more starches or grains, but there's another component to it that we also have to take into consideration, and that's methane intensity is sometimes how we describe it, where when we feed starch, we can also improve the productive performance of the animal. And when we think about efficiency in feeding people, what we're going to want to think about is not just total production of gas, but also how much gas is produced per unit of product. So we usually express that as, say, grams or kilograms of methane per unit of milk production, so kilograms or grams of milk. And we can, by improving individual animal productivity, reduce our gas per pound of milk. So there's definitely room to explore that. But I wouldn't wholesale say that exclusively feeding grass is the only way that we can have an impact on mitigating our per unit product emissions.
John, thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it. Pete in Wautoma, we'll go to you. Hi, Pete.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I had a question in line with the similar two previous questions, and that is, beef cattle, grazing them on pasture, 100% grass and forage fed versus the grain in a confinement facility. I realize it takes longer to finish these. So you're looking at least 2 years from birth to maturity versus a regular fed in a feedlot. You're probably getting them out in a year and a half. So I think your comment was really good there. if you could just clarify for me, is there a big difference in terms of the grass-fed versus corn-fed? I'll go offline then. Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so I work less with beef. I work mostly with dairy cattle. So I'll just speak again more broadly that the longer it takes definitely to finish, that means there's going to be more feed days, et cetera, which might increase the emission intensity. But without comprehensive research using tools like the burp box, which was actually originally designed for beef cattle out in rangeland, without having these measurements, we can't quite address those questions. So this is one of the reasons why we're really excited to use this tool now at UW-Platteville.
Yeah, it's interesting. If you get them to the animals more quickly to market, they're obviously no longer going to be producing methane versus grass-fed, where they might take longer. And so it could come out as a wash almost.
I don't know about a wash, but it's definitely something we talk a lot about in the nutrition space. Our term is the dilution of maintenance, you can call it. And really what we're talking about is trying to spread out our input costs. So if we can reduce the number of days of input to our finished product, we can usually reduce our not only our inputs, but our outputs in terms of emissions. So there's definitely a balancing act. And further research looking at the intensity of emissions can help us optimize where that balance might be. Maybe there is a combination of more grain or starch less grain or starch with more forages, which we wouldn't be opposed to,
sure.
Especially using homegrown forages and pasture to optimize this gas emission intensity.
You can join in too, by the way. The number to call is 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234. Or you could email us, the email address, talk@WPR.org. That's talk@WPR.org. Are you hearing a lot or seeing a lot of interest among farmers for this work and research, Ryan?
Oh, absolutely. You know, the term burp box is super engaging. And I think it's a new technology. It's a new measurement. And farmers are very often very interested in data and monitoring. And once we start monitoring things, we can start managing things. So there is definitely a lot of interest. And part of that's also, it's not just the social license or pressures in terms of sustainability, but also when we think about it, farmers are interested in efficiency. And actually, if we can manage for less emissions, we actually could manage for greater energy or input efficiency for our production system. Because CO2 methane is made out of carbon, and the best parts of milk, the fat and the protein that we use for our dairy products, those are also made out of carbon. So every bit of carbon that the cow is burping into the air is carbon that could have been going to milk or meat in the beef sector and the dairy sector for beef, too.
Yeah, very interesting. Matt in Middleton, we'll go to you now. Hi, Matt.
Hi. As a farmer, I'm not a dairy farmer, I'm a vegetable producer, but I have relatives that are dairy farmers. I think a lot of this is an academic discussion unless there's a financial incentive. So many of my relatives are operating on such thin margins that going to either a grass-based diet or even a grain crop that is less productive is financially unprofitable. So barring some type of legislation that says you must do this, there has to be a financial incentive for the farmer. I mean, usually it's 1 acre of grass for one beef cow to raise it to maturity. So if you're a farmer and you've got 300 head of cattle, you're going to get much more production out of them by feeding some grain than putting them strictly on grass. And even then, in today's environment for farmers, the margins are really thin.
Yeah. And Matt, by the way, I hope you stay listening, because at the top of the hour at noon today, I'll be talking with Brian Reisinger about his book, Land Rich, Cash Poor, about family farms here in Wisconsin and across the nation, and we'll certainly be touching on some of the things that you raise. So I hope you'll stay tuned for that. But Brian, in the meantime, comment on Matt's notes.
Oh, I absolutely agree with Matt. We need to find some balance here. And I think my previous comment there was getting at how by potentially managing for less emissions, we can capture some efficiency, which would help in the penny pinching economy that can be this low margin agricultural market. But also, and I'll actually agree, it is an academic discussion right now, because by implementing these tools and monitoring and seeing how our different managements can impact gas emissions, especially the intensity of emissions, then we can reinforce what we might already be doing in agriculture through these academic pursuits. So managing for greater milk yield through fats or through greater milking frequency might reduce intensity and reinforce in the story of dairy production and agriculture are practices that are actually helping our products be more sustainable from an emissions standpoint.
Matt, thank you again. Appreciate the call. You said farmers are interested in this. I mean, are dairy farmers concerned about methane emissions as you've talked with them?
There definitely are progressive farmers that are concerned about it. And again, there are other people who are interested in how this can help them with their bottom line and capturing efficiency. It's a 6 to 12% loss in gross energy to methane emission. And that could really impact that low margin bottom line.
Yeah. Is this technology, I guess it's available. When do you think it'll be commercially available to farmers?
Well, I think the company CELOC wouldn't be opposed to selling it to farmers. I think because of this is not a cheap equipment, I think what we have to think about more is, and because farmers are not getting paid based on emissions right now, I think we have to think about more what type of programming we can surround it for if we want people to do this type of monitoring. What kind of partnerships can we have where we could collectively use a green feed unit that could be transported between farms for short-term analysis or auditing?
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense to me. You mentioned earlier robotic milkers, and that's another part of the cutting edge technology you're testing at the Pioneer, UW Platteville's Pioneer Farm, which I mean, maybe you might want to talk about that for a minute as well, because that's a pretty cool operation.
Yeah. So I think about 3 years ago, we upgraded our facilities and put in two new Lely A5 automated milking systems or robotic milking systems. And we made some other financial investments in research equipment at the feed bunk where we're measuring individual intakes of cattle too. So now I have a 50 cow research pen where we're looking from feed bunk to milking robot, bulk tank, and now to cow burps, how different interventions, whether that's feed or permission systems in the robot, impact cows. And to delve a little bit deeper in the potential of automated milking systems, it's a voluntary system, much like the green feed, where cows visit to get milked throughout the day. As they feel like it, they get another tasty treat while they're getting milked to help encourage them to go. And the machine completely milks the cow by itself. It's less human labor intensive, And it also gives us an opportunity to individually manage cows with the robot, feeding different feeds in the robot, different amounts of feed, milking them different numbers of times a day, et cetera. So really cool technology that we're excited UW Platteville gets to be on the cutting edge.
Yeah, that's really cool. Tim in Watertown has a comment for us. Tim, hi.
Hi, I saw an article recently about a feed additive that's just become commercially available. I think commercially available from a company that significantly cuts methane gas. And I did a rough calculation, and it seems like it's affordable, but it's probably going to be one of these things, to be honest, that would have to have some government inducements to get people to use it. But I was fascinated by the fact that, it's out there, and that's one, if you add up the cost, it's probably worth checking into.
Yeah. And Ryan, you're familiar with that?
Yeah, I believe the product that you're talking about is commercially known as Bovaer. The chemistry name is 3-NOP, and it's a chemical agent that actually prevents the methanogens in the cow's stomach from producing methane gas. And they see about a 10 to 30% reduction in the methane specifically that's being produced from the cow. So it does seem to be very effective with minimal impact on the cow otherwise. Right now, if you're not being paid for reducing your emissions, there's definitely going to be limited benefit. But there's also a lot of other ways that we could potentially reduce methane emissions dietarily. And I know one that we've used historically that doesn't have it as big of a punch to the emissions is things like unsaturated fatty acids, which could also support the cow biologically in terms of energy and creating hormones, et cetera, for the cow.
Yeah. And Betsy emailed to say they watched a recent public TV program about feeding cattle seaweed to lower emissions. So there's lots going on out there. Lots going on out there. And it's I'm really glad that we were able to have a chance to talk with you today, Ryan. I look forward to, I hope we can do this again. When you get some more data collected, let's get back together and talk. Let's talk again. Thank you.
That would be awesome. I'd love to do it. Thank you so much for having me, Larry. It's been a pleasure.
Ryan Prowley is an assistant professor of animal, dairy, and veterinary sciences at UW Platteville's School of Agriculture. Well, coming up, we're going to take a look at some latest information on CWD in our dairy herd. I'm Larry Mueller. Well, chronic wasting disease has been detected in wild and farmed white-tailed deer in more than half of Wisconsin's 72 counties. And the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources is currently reviewing its management policy for the disease. Larry Mueller here. It's great to have back to Michael Foy to talk with us about CWD. Michael, a retired DNR field wildlife biologist, over 15 years of experience with CWD. Mike's a current member of the Wildlife Work Group for Wisconsin's Green Fire. It provides science-based analysis and conservation policy recommendations. So it's great to have him back. Brian Reisinger will be with us at noon to talk about his book, Land Rich, Cash Poor. But first, want to hear from you about CWD. Are you going deer hunting this fall? If you harvest a deer, do you get it tested or know how to do it? Give us a call. The number's 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or you can send an email to talk@WPR.org. Mike Foy, welcome back. Good to have you with us again. Been a long time.
Yeah, it has been, Larry. Thank you very much. I'm happy to be here.
Well, not so happy about chronic wasting disease. It's been found in at least one wild deer in 46 of our 72 counties, if I'm not mistaken, and quite prevalent in some counties, probably more than others.
That's correct. It's still primarily concentrated in the southwestern counties where it was first discovered in 2002 testing of 2001 deer taken right outside of Madison in the town of Vermont. Three deer were taken that first season of 2001, and they were looking for other diseases and just were taking samples for anything that might be interesting, and boom, it popped up. So it was quite a shock.
Indeed, it was a shock. I remember that very well. And, you know, CWD is kind of like Creutzfeldt-Jakob disease in humans. If you get it, the deer is a dead, essentially, isn't
yep.
it?
Yep. Let's be clear that there have been no human cases of CWD reported
right.
yet, but it is a very similar disease. Creutzfeldt-Jakob is unique to people, I believe, and CWD is unique to cervids, and there may be some concern about other similar, ungulates and such, but it's pretty much unique to humans, unique to the deer family at this point, but there are also other versions for mink and other things. So it's a scary kind of disease. You don't want to get it, but let's be clear, it hasn't ever been shown to be in people yet.
Yeah, and I understand that chronic wasting disease in deer is leveling off in some of those most heavily infected Wisconsin counties. Is that correct?
Well, that's what it looks like. The question is why, and is it really happening? But, for many years, we had basically exponential disease prevalence increase in those areas where we first discovered it, southwestern counties. But as any biology student here on campus can tell you, you can't have exponential growth forever, and at some point it's going to level off. Either because a population will, in a closed system, will go extinct, or it will start to vary around an asymptote, and that's what appears to be happening. Now the question is why, and we're not sure that's really good news, because it just means that CWD really has its claws in us down there.
Yeah. So what percentage of, I mean, you guys have done it with the Green Fire and others have done some research on it. What percentage of the deer herd is infected?
Well, overall, in some of the most infected counties, Iowa, Richland, Sauk, it's varying right around 25, 27, 30%. In adult males, it can be higher than that. Adult females are typically lower, and then yearling males are kind of bounce around, but they're usually around the same as adult females, and then yearling females are less than any of the other three cohorts. So, but we've had areas where we see prevalence up into the 40s for short periods, even probably crossing into the 50%. So it's quite alarming. And again, unlike other diseases that typically you have a certain percentage of the population that recovers and then has at least some resistance to reinfection, we don't know that to be the case yet in CWD. It seems to be pretty universally fatal from what the research scientists tell us.
Yeah, and we should maybe review how's it spread. It's spread through at least saliva, I'm pretty sure.
Yeah, saliva, feces. There was concern about whether fawns born of infected mothers would be sick, and it doesn't seem to pass in utero, but it can. A fawn can relatively quickly become infected if it has an infected mother, because just, you know, the constant grooming that happens when they're young, the licking and everything like that. So it is primarily basically bodily fluids that contain this misshapen protein called a prion. So it's not a bacteria, it's not a virus, it's not a fungus. It's basically something that all mammals have in us, these proteins, and only when they become misshapen do they cause disease, and that's a part of a problem for trying to figure out how to treat it, is because the body doesn't readily recognize these proteins as being foreign bodies, and so it doesn't develop antibodies to them and to our understanding. So it's a real challenge.
Yeah, it is. And it's affected, I think, Wisconsin's deer hunting culture and traditions. I mean, is that your feeling?
I agree 100%, Larry. I can just give an example on my own land in Iowa County. For the last 5 deer that I've taken off my own family's land have been sick. And I'm getting to an age where, you know, hauling them up out of the bottoms and up to the top of the hill where the cars are parked is not as easy as it once was. And it's just something you really have to start thinking about is, okay, what am I going to do with this? Is it something I want to take and spend money to get processed right away? Or do I want to do it myself, only to find out later that it's CWD positive, and I really do not want to eat that or feed it to my family? It's a real concern, and I think it's taken the shine off a little bit, and the thing we're trying to do is figure out is how we can get this to a level where it doesn't really dominate our CWD or deer management, but might become a nuisance or something, but something we can live with, but not going to be a real problem for us. Where, you know, I have trouble putting a deer in the freezer because they're all sick on my land.
Yeah, it's I've heard very similar stories from others who have just kind of gotten disgusted with 4 or 5 in a row, and you just wonder, well, what's why should I even be out there?
Yeah, and there's real concern, too, about, you know, the next generation. It's a very exciting thing for a young person to get their first deer, and or you know, young adult hunters. I mentor hunters for many years on my land, and when they get them, and then if they come back sick, it's like, well, I just...
Yeah.
That just takes the enjoyment and the accomplishment right off the table. It's really sad.
You can join in, too. Questions or comments about CWD, our guest Michael Foy, give a call. The number's 800-642-1234, or you could email us to talk@wpr.org. Richard in Two Rivers, we'll give you a chance. Hi, Richard.
Yeah, hi. Michael said that it didn't cross the barrier into humans, but it has. I'll give you a perfect example. It was large containment hogs, and Hormel. I shouldn't say Hormel. They had a brain line where they were cutting the brains out, and they were doing 40,000 pigs a day, and the people all got contaminated with chronic wasting disease.
So I need to clarify that the different spongiform diseases can cross species barrier. And the famous example is mad cow, where the bovine version crossed over, probably got infected through animal feed supplements, possibly from sheep, no one's quite certain, but it got into the cattle, then transmitted it to humans, most notoriously in the United Kingdom. So you're right that there is the potential for all these to cross over, but I do need to correct you that we have no knowledge, at least that I have any awareness of, that CWD has ever crossed into people. It has not been shown to happen, to my knowledge.
And I think Richard was talking about swine and hogs operation, which would be a different, it wouldn't be CWD, would it?
No, and I am not familiar with that case or that situation, but many species have different, not species, families of livestock and animals have their own types of TSE diseases, and in very rare cases, they can cross over into other species or other families of mammals once they get over this barrier to transmission. It's very hard to do, but it does happen, but it has not happened with CWD.
Mm-hmm. All right. Richard, thank you again. You can join in too at 800-642-1234, email to talk at WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Talking today with Michael Foy, retired DNR field wildlife biologist. He's a member of the working group of Greenfire, and it provides science-based analysis and conservation recommendations. Great to have him with us. Lots of callers with questions. Bruce in Bayfield County. I'm sorry, Bruce. What's on your mind?
I'm wondering. I tuned in late, and I'm wondering: do the affected deer manifest? Can you tell? Do they look sick, or is the only way to find out for sure is to have them tested?
Great question, Bruce. Yes and no. When deer get to what's called the clinical stage, which is usually after at least a year of infection, potentially as much as 2 years, average I think is 15, 17 months, something like that, they start to waste. That's where the name comes from. They waste away. They quit feeding as vigorously. And basically they get thinner, they start to have other very common symptoms, drooping ears, kind of a vacant, unaware look in their eyes, and sometimes drooling, things like that. And, you know, those can, you know, and they get very skinny, and you can see the bones, you can see the spine, you can see the hip pointers. You know, if you see a deer like that, there's a good possibility in certain parts of the state, particularly the Southwest, as I said, that deer has CWD. Having said that, part of my former job at DNR was to go out and investigate these things, and we, you know, we removed a number of very sick-looking deer from people's barnyards and places that ended up having internal injuries from a car deer collision or something like that, and just were off their feed. So you can't tell for sure without having the test done, but you can see the symptoms in an advanced stage disease. But for the vast majority of the deer, you cannot tell when they're in the field. They look perfectly fine, they act perfectly fine, and there's no really good way to tell, which is one of the real challenges about how to try and manage and control the disease.
Bruce, thank you again. How long does it take to get a test back? Bruce was wondering.
I think the average last year was 9 days, which is I find to be extraordinary. The DNR has really been working on this. Back in the early days, it would take 3, 4, 5. You know, if you got a deer on opening weekend and then got way in the back of the line, it could take, in some cases, multiple months. But they've really been working to try and speed it up, and also the Wisconsin Veterinary Diagnostic Lab has really scaled things up, their equipment and their staffing, and they've just gotten really better at turning the results around. But it's still, you know, an inconvenience. It's hard, especially early in the season. What do you do with a deer when it's warm out and you don't have your test results immediately? And so the hope to get a very rapid test, one that can be used in the field, is high on the minds of a lot of research folks. And there's been some progress made that way using some very sophisticated testing techniques that we will have a readily available and affordable field test. But I need to say that, you know, just having quicker test results doesn't help with that problem of how do you tell which deer are sick before you shoot. So, or, you know, trying to shoot deer that are sick. So it's a real management problem.
Bob in Sun Prairie, it's your turn. Hi, Bob.
Hi, I got a two-part question, actually. I have quit deer hunting myself, but years ago I grew up in Waupaca County, which is a huge deer country, and I hunted, and mainly it was a family thing. But anyway, a lot of the old hunters that I talked to from that area, they think chronic wasting disease has been around for a long, long, long time. So I'm wondering if there's any research on how long it's been around. And the second part of my question is, I have a good friend who died actually from a form of brain cancer, and his son has told me that he firmly believes it had something to do with his father eating primarily venison and elk. He was also an elk hunter and would bring elk home from Wyoming and out that way. And I'm wondering, is there any difference between the CWD in elk and in deer?
Generally, no. It's this very similar, potentially identical. Each individual species has its own genotype, and the genes are not always perfectly aligned. But for most, you know, most purposes, you can say that the disease is the same, but how the species reacts to the disease can vary some. So, you know, the mule deer, whitetails, elk, they all have a little bit of a different disease progression and such. And then your first part, Bob, about was about whether a brain cancer could have been from it. Not that I'm aware of. You know, cancer is a terrible thing, of course, but I have not heard of cancer being a source of disease mortality from CWD. It is it's more of a loss of you know, the ability for the brain to control the body's functions and such like that. So both terrible diseases, but but not very similar as far as I know.
Thank you, Bob, for calling. Forrest in Stevens Point will go to you next. Hi, Forrest. Thank you for calling.
Good morning. My question, and I'll take the answer off here. So what would you feel is the best management, trying to get this under control, including statewide baiting bans, et cetera, possibly the elimination of high fence hunt situations, et cetera, et cetera. There seems to be a business interest that tends to override good science, and having our politicians involved, and I know every one of them are, you know, wildlife biologists by training. I can see it. Is that one of the issues, is getting the political spectrum out of this equation? And I'll take my answer off air.
Well, in some ways, that's the proverbial $64,000 question for us. I think what the DNR has been reviewing their response plan and getting ready to do a new version of it. And they've brought in a number of experts, one of them who is a really, really smart modeler that is able to plug in all these things. And I'm pretty sure he's concluded, and everybody I know says likewise that studies this, is there is no one silver bullet. But some things we can do is get our deer herd lower overall. We're not talking about going back to what we were first trying in the early 2000s, which is get it very low, but let's try and get it down. I mean, right now we're going to be close to 2 million deer, which is an awful lot, the historically high numbers. And so one thing right there that is new for this year is there's going to be a, if you harvest a CWD positive deer, it used to be, I have one in my hunting bag right now, you get a replacement tag if you shot a buck, and you would get a replacement tag for an antlerless deer if you shot an antlerless deer. Well, new this year, this was the idea of Doug Duren, and who also has had some other really good ideas, like the adopt a kiosk thing to help people have more convenient sampling, and adopt a dumpster. And basically, if you shoot a CWD positive antlerless deer, you get an either sex tag that you can use in the same deer management unit in the same land type. So that's a really good idea, and I think it may help people, say, hey, let's take another antlerless deer and help out. And then we also have the deer donation and a lot of ways to help people use that venison and potentially get venison to people that don't hunt. So,
Charlie wonders, should everyone who shoots a deer have it tested regardless of where they are?
Well, I would say, Charlie, that is really what we would love to see, particularly in areas where we don't have a lot of information. And that's pretty easy. You can go right on the DNR's website, and you can find whole townships and in some cases whole sections that have, or the other way around, that have really very few samples. We don't necessarily need a lot of more samples in Iowa County, but from a personal standpoint, I test every deer I hunt, I shoot, and I bring home, because I don't want to be the guy that makes medical history and has this jump over into people. And it is just something that it would be great if we would test more deer at some limit. At some point, we can't test our entire deer harvest, 300,000 a year. The cost would be enormous, but you can certainly help out, and you can ask your local DNR wildlife biologists where samples are needed, or if they're needed from your farm.
Michael, on that note, we're out of time. We had lots of callers still with questions or comments, but I appreciate your time, and I hope we can get you. I think it's been about 5 years since you've been here. We're going to get you back sooner than that.
Yeah, Larry, and as long as I'm correcting people, I just want to make sure that earlier when we were on the shift change here, you said CWD and dairy cattle. That is not happening. Please don't run to the phones with alarm. Thank you very much. I enjoyed being here.
Michael Foy, retired DNR wildlife biologist. Boy, that was a slip of the tongue. Well, coming up, we're going to talk about a new book on farms and farming. Stay with us. I'm Larry Mueller. Thanks so much for joining us today on WPR News. Larry Mueller here. And for the next hour, we're going to spend some time talking with Brian Reisinger, who has authored a great new book. He worked on his dad's farm, family farm in Sauk County, but like a lot of family farm members of his generation, Brian decided not to take over the business. He became a journalist, and here to talk about his new book. The book is titled Land Rich, Cash Poor, and the subtitle's My Family's Hope and the Untold Story of the Disappearing American Farmer. And as we talk together, I hope you'll join in. Did you grow up on a farm or live on a farm, or maybe you are farming right now? Definitely love to hear from you. What do you think of, what do you think America lost along with farms in rural communities over the last, 50 years or so? Give us a call. The number's 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or you can send an email to talk@wpr.org. That's talk@wpr.org. Brian Reisinger, thank you so much for taking time to be with us today. I really appreciate it.
Hey, Larry, I appreciate being on. Thanks so much.
I loved how you weaved your own family's story and history into the context of all that's happened nationally with farms, and you were pretty frank. It was kind of a warts and all kind of thing.
I appreciate you saying that. I appreciate your kind words about the book. For us, it really started, I say us because it's me and my family story, and it really started with those stories, you know, growing up, seeing farms disappearing over the years. Even as a kid, I understood something was going on. Parents would, you know, be talking with teachers. Teachers would raise your hand and say, hey, how many of you grew up on a farm? I'd raise my hand. They were fewer and fewer every year. So this story has been with us for a very long time. And telling those family stories, I got to say there were fair number of tears at 5 a.m. I write early in the morning when only the farmers are awake, and sorting through what you want to say is a process. But I'm glad we did it, and I'm thankful my family was as open as they were.
Yeah, there must have been some wonderful conversations in many ways, I would think.
Yeah, you know, you mentioned me not farming, and I'm glad you did, because I pursued a career off the farm in journalism, public policy, but I never lost my love for my roots. And there was a lot of time in my life, and there's still days where I wish I had farmed. I wish I had that in me. I didn't have the talent for cattle and crops that my dad had and that my sister has. I'm glad they're taking it forward. But there's still days where I feel that desire as the first eldest son in four generations not to farm, to have farmed. And telling this story was a way to, you know, tell something truthful about an urgent issue and honor my roots, but also, you know, honestly, lay a little bit of that burden down with my dad, who was always so supportive of me. But if we're being honest with each other, he always wished I had a farm, and I always wished I had too, in a way.
So. Yeah. Well, that's and how our government, how a lot of things transpired over the course of time. And I really liked how you sort of went back to the beginning in a way, and you did it by going back to your great-grandfather, Alois. Is that how you pronounce it, the name, Alois?
You know, we always said it Alois, but then I met people from Bavaria, and they told me it ought to have been Alois, and they were laughing at me. So I guess we can call it whatever we'd like, you know?
Well, he came and managed to get a farm, start farming in the, I think around 1919, wasn't it, or something like that?
Yeah, it was early 1900s. And I'll tell you what, every farm generation has a story, some kind of origin story like this. He came over, he escaped pre-World War I Europe, he and my great-grandma, and they began looking for farms in the rolling hills of southern Wisconsin. People know the Driftless region, of course. That's where we're from. So these are remote farms. These are hills. He actually got our farm in the year of the Blue Norther, which was the worst winter on record. There were winter tornadoes, and this man came across an ocean, traveled into the hills of Wisconsin, braved that kind of weather all to get started. And, you know, that was our start. So,
yeah, and he was interested in, well, he chose dairying primarily.
Yeah, that's right. This was at a time in the early 1900s, and this is where I learned so much about the birth of America's dairyland as I was tracing my family story and weaving that with the issues that drove what happened to our farms. At that time, there was mixed agriculture in Wisconsin and so many other places. I tell people, think of Charlotte's Web. Every animal, every crop and product you could imagine, everybody, you know, what could you grow to get money in your pocket and food on your table? And dairy emerged in Wisconsin, interestingly, because we had really fertile soil, good work ground, but we didn't have a lot of flat ground, you know? So Nebraska and Kansas, those are places for wheat and things like that, where you plant as much as you can per acre. In Wisconsin, we had some great soil, but not quite as much wide open land. So we had to figure out, how can you do something with that soil that can be potent enough to make a living? And what they found was it could raise, you know, alfalfa and good feed for milk cows. And so the innovation of trying to do dairy in Wisconsin, which was discovered not just by farmers, but industry advocates at the UW and all kinds of leaders, brought us kind of emerging as America's Dairyland. And that really took root as my great-grandpa, Alois Risinger, was getting his start.
And then he gets started, and boom, almost right away, you know, there was a huge drop in land values, kind of a crash.
Yeah, that's right. So in each chapter, I tried to tell a hidden story. What's that thing beneath the surface that affected things that maybe has been lost to history? And in that era, it was really, you know, everybody knows, of course, that Black Thursday 1929 was the Great Depression, and that put farm country and everyone else into huge economic malaise. In farm country, including in Wisconsin, we had economic depression earlier than that for 10 years because there was a price crash after World War I. We thought we were going to be feeding Europe, and they got back up on their feet sooner than expected. So the prices dropped, and we had a rural financial crisis that started years before the rest of the country. So farmers had been battered for years by the time of the Great Depression, and that's what Alois lived, and his eldest son, my grandpa, Albert Risinger, who grew up in 2 decades of poverty before climbing into the middle class as a result.
Yeah. Casey in Madison has something for us. Let's go there. Hi, Casey.
Hello. So I grew up in Dodge County and worked on the neighbor's farm. I was surrounded by farms, and most of the farms were in the 30 to 100 head of dairy cow. And I was just home the other day, and my old boss drove by, still has about 40 head of milking cow. But then my other neighbor has about 100 when I was growing up in the 80s and 90s, and now he has about 2,000. And there's been a real sort of shift to that industrial farm sort of focus, and a consolidation of all of those herds into those big industrial farms. And I'm surprised that the Baden family farm is still going with their 40 head. So
yeah, Casey, thanks a lot for calling. And Brian, I mean, this is something that you really lean into in your book.
Yeah, you know, we experienced a story very similar to that. I grew up on a 50-cow dairy, and we saw the same thing happen to farms around. There are some small ones still last, and there are many that went out of business or sold, and then there are many other bigger farms. In fact, as I did the economic research on this to weave that with my family story and learn what happened, the midpoint for dairy cows when my dad was taking over the farm from my grandpa was about 80 cows. So at 50 or 40, you know, you're on the lower end, but you're still kind of medium. Now it's 1,200. And from 80 cows to 1,200 cows, as far as the average herd size, that's a really big change. And what I found was that there are a variety of reasons for that. There are economic, social, political, technological, some things we wouldn't control and that are natural things that happen in the market. Some of them are very unnatural things, stamping out farmers. And we wrestle with that farm size because a lot of these farms They got bigger trying to do what everyone else is trying to do. They got bigger trying to make it. And at the same time, there are farms that didn't want to go that route. And there are pluses and minuses to what's happened to our farming today. My overall conclusion as I was looking at this is we need to find a way for more of our farms to be able to make it. And there is still some potential to do that. But boy, a lot of it has been wiped out over the course of the past century to the tune of 45,000 farms per year annually for the past century across the country.
Yeah, it's like three farms a day here in Wisconsin are going out of business, which is a huge amount. And I want to give other callers a chance to join in, so let me just mention the number to call, 800-642-1234, or you could email us to talk@WPR.org. Talking with Brian Risinger today about his book, Land Rich, Cash Poor, My Family's Hope and the Untold Story of the Disappearing American Farmer. And it meant a lot to me, by the way, to read the book, too, because I grew up on a farm. My dad and my grandpa farmed 240 acres. We had 60 cows or so, and that was considered a pretty decent-sized farm back when they started.
Yeah. Yeah, that's very similar to our experience. When my grandpa Albert took over from my great-grandpa, he had about 30 cows he could fit in his barn at that time in the 1940s. And he started on another neighboring farm. So we had my great-grandpa and the other kids working the original home farm. And then my grandpa had gotten his way into another farm up the hill. So you were seeing growing number of farms and we were experiencing more prosperity. And my grandpa was climbing middle class doing that. And he did that on 30, 40 cows, you know. And by the time we got to the 1950s and 60s, he saw that that was going to be getting to be too small. So he had added onto the barn just to be able to do 50 cows, which at this point is a very, very small dairy farm, as we've been discussing. Mm-hmm. So it's been an interesting evolution for sure.
And you talk about in the book contradictory incentives for farmers. You know, I talked to somebody not too long ago who was kind of miffed about farmers. He said, "Well, they seem kind of conservative, and they kind of poo-poo help for others sometimes." But this was him talking, but they accept a lot of help too. But on the other hand, there are a lot of those incentives that really were contradictory for farmers and have been over the years.
Yeah, that's right. Here's the issue that we have. And I found this as I was researching the book, but also as I'm traveling around the country talking about the book with people in Wisconsin and elsewhere. I'll tell you, you can find people on the left and on the right and within farming and outside of farming, and everyone can tell you something they don't like about our current farm programs. And I think part of the reason for that is one of the economists I talked to about this, he described our farm programs like a fragile Jenga tower, where you keep piling programs on top of one another. Many of the programs go all the way back to the 1930s. You keep piling on new programs. Our government leaders really haven't been spending time rolling up their sleeves and figuring out how to fully reform programs. Okay, is this one working the way it ought to? Isn't it? Do we reform it or do we get rid of it? If we're bringing something else in new, how does that interact with these other programs? There isn't a lot of that going on. In fact, the farm bill, they just punted it again, and it's going to be getting worked on in December. And this is a five-year bill that affects a whole industry. So when they kind of are doing their last-minute thing and passing little patchwork, there isn't real serious legislating going on. So I think we could probably pull that all apart, and there's hundreds of programs. We could look at them, and we could debate, Larry, we like this one, we don't like that one. People might feel differently. You could debate the merits of each one. The problem is they're all mashed together and not working the way they ought to. And a lot of it is that the subsidies and all that stuff becomes, you know, it becomes prone to abuse and favoritism and doesn't necessarily get into where it ought to go. So we have this dilemma where people say, boy, the farms get all kinds of support, but at the same time, there's a lot of farms disappearing. Why is that? Part of the reason is because we haven't been having that serious discussion around how are these programs working? What do we need to do with them to make sure they're doing what they're supposed to? And do we want to keep having them or do we want to try something different?
Well, it's like 90% of the crop insurance dollars, for example, you quote that, goes to the very largest, a small percentage of the farms.
Yeah, that's right. And the other thing is, you know, there's a lot of crops that don't have any kind of crop insurance. Yes. And, you know, the premise behind it was, hey, we got to have, I mean, there's a lot of things that go into it. But one of the premises that I think a lot of more people agree on than not is we ought to have some sort of baseline safety net for around things like uncontrollable weather factors. You know, I mean, you want to have a stable food supply and that kind of thing. But we have all kinds of subsidies that go into one direction, one crop or one type of farm. And then you got, you know, good example is like all the fruit growers and stuff like that. A lot of vegetable growers, oftentimes they don't have any kind of crop insurance at all. And so, you know, you really get a system that begins steering farmers in funny directions.
Sam and Shauna, we'll get to you in just a minute. A reminder again, our guest today, Brian Risinger, his book, Land Rich, Cash Poor. You can join in at 800-642-1234 or email to talk at WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. We're looking at the book, Land Rich, Cash Poor, with the author, Brian Risinger, today. It's great to have him with us. Outstanding book, and I hope you have a chance to take a look at it. And you can join in with your own thoughts about family farms here in Wisconsin and in our country. And lots of callers online already, so let's go to the phone. Sam and Shauna will give you a chance. Hi, Sam.
Hi, Larry.
What's on your mind?
Thanks for having me.
Yeah.
What's on my mind is that when I listen to this sad news of small farms in Wisconsin disappearing to the benefit of large industrial farms, looks to me that that's something that from small kings to kingdoms to empires, and then now in our society, small churches dying with only some of the bigger ones remaining, and even small stores disappearing, eaten up by Walmart and probably soon by Amazon. That's my comment.
Yeah. Brian, comment?
Yeah, you know, this is actually something, although I was looking at our farm economy and how that affects not only farm families, but things like our food prices and other things. As I was looking at this, I saw that it's something that's happening economy-wide in a very big way, which is to say our economy in America is increasingly dominated by really large entities, and that's across all kinds of industries, and that speaks to some of the concerns that the caller had. It also seeks to explain a little bit of things for some of those folks who've gotten a little bigger. What I mean by that is, you know, those bigger farms, they were smaller, medium-sized farms at one time. They got bigger, in part trying to keep up with the agribusiness companies that were getting bigger. Those agribusiness companies were keeping up with the food companies. Those food companies are keeping up with retailers and on throughout the whole economy. So we have this economy-wide issue where we have much bigger entities, and that affects so many of our industries, so much of whether there are small businesses or others who have agency to try to steer their way through the economy. And so everybody's trying to keep up with everybody else. And so in the case of our farms, we have a number of farms, of course, that have gotten much, much bigger, and they're trying to keep up with the rest of the economy. And also they might be supporting more than one family. And I say that only so that we understand that it's part of a broader system. It's something that's a problem across our entire economy that needs to be addressed. And at the same time, it puts many of those medium and small size farms in a really tough position. And it does add to the difficult pressure for those farms as well. There's no question about that.
And you do talk in your book about, you look at large, medium, and small farms, and those medium farms, they're the ones like your farms, but, you know, get caught in the middle there. The small farms, well, go ahead and explain that.
Yeah, this was the part that my sister and I lived through with my parents in the 90s. You know, I'm lucky we had a good middle class living, but we could feel it was slipping away. And one of the things that was going on is we were a mid-sized farm, and you had the big farms that were getting bigger and had economic scale to be able to make it. You had many of the smaller farms that what they were slipping into was having farmers working multiple jobs. You know, it wasn't a full-time farm. It was a supplemental income situation. You had these mid-sized farms that were too big to be a part-time job and not big enough to make it. So they're caught in the middle. And the experts I talked to call that the hollowing out of the middle. And boy, I'll tell you, when they said that, hit me right in the gut, because it felt like what we had been experiencing. And now we have very few true medium-sized farms anymore in this country, what the government considers medium. We got big, we got a very small sliver of medium, and then we got a bunch of small. And those small ones, boy, I mean, our farm is considered that. And as I said, my dad and sister are still farming, and we're not an exception to this. Most of those small farms are working multiple jobs. You got people who are pulling factory shifts, working construction jobs, pouring concrete and farming. And so it's a difficult situation where it's not a full-time income for those families.
Yeah, and I was back to our caller's other point. I think when you start losing a lot of the farms, those small community, I mean the churches, the local stores, the people are gone, or many of the people are gone.
Oh, that's absolutely right. You know, Plain, Wisconsin, where I'm from in southwestern part of the state in Sauk County, was a community that was built by the farmers. There were German and Swiss immigrants and others who came into the area, and the prosperity of those farms, even though it was a hard time, digging your living out of the dirt, and a lot of it was subsistence farming, it was coming along, and it was entrepreneurial, and they were growing the community. And now, you know, the death of so many of our farms is not unlike the loss of manufacturing jobs and other things that have happened in our rural communities and our small towns, and they're losing people as well. And that is something that has begun to really sap a lot of the vitality out of our small towns. Now, there's a lot of resilience left. I don't want to sound too dour about it.
Yeah.
There's a lot of resilience left. But, boy, has it really taxed our rural and small towns in Wisconsin.
Let's take a call from Brock in Stevens Point next. Hi, Brock.
Okay. Hello, Larry. Thank you for taking my call. My paternal grandparents were dairy farmers, and growing up, I spent a lot of time on the farm and have many great memories. I was also a 4-H'er throughout my teenage years, and I have to say I'm quite sad to see that a lot of the families that I grew up with who were dairy farmers are no longer in business. And one of the questions that came up is, you know, what is lost now with the changing dairy industry? And I think it's a connection to the land, to animals, to food, you know, understanding where food is coming from or producing it ourselves. And without being too critical of the large farms that we see today, I have to say that I'm quite sad not to see cows grazing out in the fields like I did when I was growing up. You know, the landscapes were dotted with black and white Holsteins, and you rarely see that today.
Mm. Yeah. You know, there's a personal element and an economic element in what Brock's talking about. And from the personal side, and Larry, you know this, and so many of our listeners do it too. But, you know, growing up working with my dad early in the morning, coming down when a calf was being born, seeing it take its first breaths, you know, seeing him send the cow dog out to the pasture to bring the cows in with just a whistle. These are magical things, living close to the land. It gets down in your blood and your bones, and it really means something. And we're not only losing that, which is really valuable, I think, but also the loss of our farms is doing all kinds of things. It's helping to drive up our food prices. The reason I say that is because as we lose our farms and we lose many other small businesses involved in getting our food from the farm gate to the dinner table, there are fewer distribution channels. And we saw during COVID the way that that disrupts things, and the food prices are higher if you can get what you're looking for. Then our food supply itself is at times in danger, as we again saw in COVID. We're also losing innovation because we have an industry under so much distress that it isn't able to innovate in the same way, even though it's a proud tradition in American agriculture. It isn't able to innovate like they used to. That drives the prices. But then it goes so far beyond that. It affects our environment. It affects our health. It affects our rural-urban divide when you have places feeling left behind like that. So I like to say that we're not only, well, I shouldn't say I like to say it, I hate to say it, that we're not only losing the farms that feed us, but we're losing a part of ourselves along the way.
Brock, thank you for calling. Dylan in Owen, Wisconsin, your turn. Hi, Dylan.
Hi. We have 60 dairy cows. I farm with my dad and my uncle. They're through our area. We still have quite a few smaller dairies, a lot of bigger Mennonite population. But the bigger ones are getting bigger around us, and put low pressure on us and stuff, but we're surviving.
Yeah. Do you work off the farm at all, Dylan, or is it all farm?
I don't. My wife works off the farm.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, thoughts, Brian? Thank you, Dylan, for calling.
I am always so glad when we hear from people who are still plugging away at it. 60 cows, very similar to our herd. And, you know, it's good to hear the the thing that I always try to talk to people about is, although we've lost 70% of our farms in this country, we do still have nearly 2 million farms. And one of the best states to find those resilient farms still sticking it out more so than other places is in Wisconsin.
Yeah.
And these smaller farms that are still making it, they oftentimes will have, you know, one spouse or someone working on a farm, sometimes someone working multiple jobs, but they're also finding ways to make it. And sometimes they might be doing what they were doing and they're just squeezing more and more efficiency out. And boy, I admire anybody who's able to do that. That takes a lot of grit and a lot of smarts, I'll tell you. The other thing that some farms are doing is they're diversifying, and we experience that. Now, we sold our dairy herd, and that's hard. That's like a death in the family when you do that, especially if it's been a 100-year tradition in your family. But we sold our herd in spring of 2021 early enough that we were able to hold on to our land and figure out other ways to farm. We know there are others who lost their land and everything with it. We held on to our land, and we're now raising custom heifers for other dairy herds. So other farms will come and have us raise their what become their milk cows. We raise beef for consumers, and we also raise a variety of cash crops and more crops than we used to because we're trying to change it up, figure out what makes sense. So for us, we're kind of returning to the days of diversified mixed agriculture and trying to find our way forward. Everybody's got to find their own path. I admire anybody who's out there still digging their living out of the ground.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. I was thinking, as Dylan mentioned his wife going to work, I was thinking back. My mother went to work off the farm. I didn't know. I was learned about this later, but it was probably in the 50s, and the community was kind of. I guess people were kind of aghast that a farm wife would actually go off the farm and work off the farm because, they're always considered equal partners. Well, we had, you know, it was my dad and my grandpa together, but.
Yeah. You know, it's so funny you say that because I've seen that through the generations of our family too. And the other thing that's really interesting is that in many ways, women in our rural farm communities help blaze a lot of paths. And
yeah.
I don't mind saying that my sister is one of those people now, but my mom and my grandma, my great grandma before that, because of what you said, you know, they're doing the work of any man on the farm, you know, and it's a partnership between a husband and a wife and the rest of the family. And so, you know, you had a lot of independent minded women who came up doing the work of a man and knowing they could do that long before the years of Rosie the Riveter, you know? And my sister came along coming to take over the farm from my dad. And she's dealt with people who, you know, turn and look and, well, shouldn't I be talking to your dad or shouldn't I be talking to a man about that machine part? And, you know, she doesn't have time for that kind of BS. And, you know, the truth is that her carrying on the farm is something that makes me so proud. And she carried the farm forward during COVID when my dad was sick, you know. And so it's really amazing what families go through and all the interesting stories that'll come up when people are trying to figure out how to make it.
Yeah, and you have lots of great family stories in your book. It was so much fun to learn about your family and how you were able to overcome a lot of things. I mean, and one thing that you had, in a way, was that your great grandfather managed to get the farm free and clear. So you were dealing with a free and clear farm. Although when your mom and dad took it over, all right, it was a free and clear farm, but they had to buy the farm from your grandparents on a land contract, which, you know, they were still paying for that farm.
Yeah, it's still a heavy lift. You're right. You know, Alice and Teresa Reisinger paid off the farm, so it'd be free and clear. Albert took over that farm and also helped buy an additional farm. He paid off that debt. When my parents came along, we were free and clear, and that was a good thing. But to your point, then the younger generation is buying the farm from the older generation over time. Each generation carried a heavy load to move it forward. And,
yeah,
you know, to your point on personal stories, I think about my dad, and one of the things that to me shows the beauty and the hardship of it is the way he was initiated into the family business. And this was when my grandpa slipped off a corn crib and he fell 30 feet through the air and hit the frozen ground and broke his back. And it was a family tragedy that occurred in the 1950s. Now, he survived. He got back on his feet. But my dad was at the tender age of 8 when this happened. And they sat him down and, you know, they talked to him about how he had to start doing the work of a man. And, you know, I get emotional just thinking about it because he hasn't quit. You know, he's been doing that for 64 years ever since. And there's a lot. Boy, that's a hard thing for a kid to go through. But at the same time, he loved the calves. He loved the clean country air. And if you were farming with my dad right now, I bet you we go out there. He's on the back of a tractor at the moment. He's having the time of his life, too. So there's a lot of hardship, but there's a lot of hope and a lot of beauty that comes along with it, too.
Kurt in Chippewa Falls will go to you, and then we'll get to Samantha. But Kurt first. Hi.
Okay, thanks. I came back. My wife and I, a couple kids, came back to my family's dairy farm when my dad died in 1995. I'm sorry, in 1976. And there were a total of 55,000 farms in Wisconsin at that time. And 45,000 of those were dairy farms. 20 years later, when we left the farm, there were only 15,000 dairy farms, and I think now it's around 8,000. I started out with 25 cows, ended up with 100 cows, and we got out of farming before we got into any more debt that we couldn't afford. Part of this reason of decline of so-called family farms is that consumers demand and expect lowest possible prices, especially in food. And so where do the processors provide that cheapest possible food is that they squeeze down the prices they pay to the producers, and the farmer is the last place where you can squeeze out more profit, and so the farmer goes, without making any profit. You commented earlier on the debt. The entire U.S. economy, including these 1,000, 2,000, 5,000 cow farms, are operating on debt and will never be out of debt. It is part of our capitalist economy, for good or for bad. And it would take an economist to explain to me whether long-term that is sustainable or not. Okay, those are my comments.
Kurt, thank you so much. Comments, Brian?
Yeah, Kurt's talking about a lot of very real economic realities. And, I thank you for your work in our agriculture industry. And you're right about so much of what's going on. One of the things that I found as we looked at this was that the consumer really does have a lot of power here to help us change things. And the good news is we're at a point where people care more about where their food came from than ever before in a post-COVID world. And there's an opportunity for us to do more to make a change to this. And Kurt's also right that, the need for food to be affordable at all costs was a really big thing driving what's going on in our food economy. It's also a big thing that drove government policy. And leaders from both parties over time really focused on just making sure that at all costs, no matter what was happening, we were getting more and more cheaper food. Now, affordable food is a good goal. It's understandable. People want affordable food in their household. What's happened is we've gotten to a point where we wiped out so many farms that, as I said, those supply chain disruptions and that lag in innovation that happens when you're battering an industry, that's starting to cause higher prices. We're starting to have price spikes that go well beyond the inflation the two parties are trying to debate. And so we kind of pursued this goal of cheap food at all costs at the risk of the sustainability of our agriculture industry. And now it has all these vulnerabilities that mean higher costs. So if we want to try to have affordable food, we need to also try to slow and stop and address the wiping out of our farms. And there's a world, I think, where we can have a more sustainable food economy that delivers affordable food and isn't squeezing out or wiping out parts of that supply chain like the farmers needlessly. We can have a balance, and we have an opportunity for that now, whereas, in decades past, maybe we didn't realize what was going on quite as well as we could now.
Thank you again for calling, and we'll get into some of those. You've got some great ideas that you pose at the end of the book. I want to wait on them for a few minutes anyway. Samantha in Galesville, though, I want to give her a chance to join in. She's been waiting a while. Hi, Samantha.
Hi. I've got two questions there. Anyway, why aren't people getting into farming as much, or like, let's say your grandpa maybe your great-grandpa and then your grandpa and then your dad had the farm, so it was like three generations or so, and then you, then the younger generation don't want to get into it. And then on the flip side of that, if somebody does want to get into it, how would you go about that? Would you promote more of the FFA stuff in school? Or how would you promote if somebody wants to get into farming and start a farm if they don't already have one in their family? Thank you.
Thanks, Samantha. She raised some interesting points there.
Very good points. And they all tie back to the issue of needing to see more economic opportunity out there for our small family farms. So to the first question around why aren't as many getting in, you know, I'll tell you, I know a lot of kids, including I have a nephew who's very interested in farming. I know all kinds of people out there who, you know, they might have gone into farming, but they ended up instead going to work in the agriculture industry in another way, or they went into the trades or went off to college for something else. All those things are noble things to do, but they might have thought about farming, but they don't have any guidance counselors telling them, boy, that would be a good career move. You know what I mean? That's not happening. And so having more of this economic opportunity, mm-hmm. to your point, Larry, we can get into how to do that. But if there was a brighter economic future, I think there's a lot of kids who are interested in farming who would turn to it if they felt like it was more of an option. And that feeds into the second question, which is a very good second and related question. How would they go about it? For families that have land in their family like we do, there's a challenge in that many of the younger generation are buying it from the older generation, but that's at least more manageable than if you're trying to get into it for the first time and there isn't any family land. It's even harder to try to farm and make enough money to make lease payments. And so we do need to try to figure out how to help with that transition. There are some programs out there. There are some folks who are beginning to zero in even more on the issue, which is that for a farmer who doesn't have a son or a daughter willing to take over the farm, they have to really take a risk on someone outside the family. Because if you were going to sell the farm as is, you just sell the land as is to a developer, whatever, and your family could be really much more prosperous. To hang on longer and to hold out for a young person to be able to pay off that farm to you, that requires a lot of trust. That's usually why it's done in the family. So there are folks who are looking at how do we make that financial transition more reasonable for the older farmer. And I think that's one of the key public policy issues that we have to try to figure out here. There's no question about that. We don't have the answers yet, but that's one of the biggest problems.
Brian Reisinger, our guest today, his book, a fantastic book. It's titled Land Rich, Cash Poor, the subtitles My Family's Hope and the Untold History of the Disappearing American Farmer. Fascinating read. And you can join in. Lines are full right now, but you'll get a chance. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Thanks so much for joining in today as we take a look at the family farm with our guest and author Brian Reisinger. His book is titled Land Rich, Cash Poor. And let's take a call from Rana in Prairie du Chien. Rana, thank you for calling.
Hi, Larry. Good afternoon, Brian. I'd like to celebrate Brian's sister for just a minute in the fact that I was in her position, 50 years ago, as the gopher running for parts here and there on the farm, doing, when the milk truck came, et cetera, and always getting that look of, well, where's your dad? Or why didn't your uncle come for these parts? It always felt kind of demeaning to me as a woman working in the ag area, of kind of being the invisible entity on the farm where I did just as much as the men. So
understood. Malia had that circumstance happened to her, probably has had it happen hundreds of times in her career on the farm.
Yeah, she has. I so appreciate that caller speaking up, and I'm so grateful that you were working in agriculture and helping to blaze a path that my sister has been part of too. And it is such an irony that women on the farm do the work same work as the men do. And are only, you know, maybe now we're starting to have more of these conversations about the sort of respect that they ought to have. You know, my sister got to a point where, you know, she'd have seed salesmen that would come in and would talk to my dad. And it's like she wasn't even sitting at the dinner table, even though she's helping make the decisions. And she got to a point where she said to me, I really handed her, she was telling me these stories. And she said, you know, I got to the point where if people can't respect me, I'm not doing business with them. And my dad was backing her up. And so we had people that, you know, if they didn't give her the time of day, they weren't doing business with our farm is what they found out. And so people learned pretty quick. I shouldn't say pretty quick, probably not quick enough, but but people learned that if they want to do business with Risinger Hilltop Farms, they had to deal with my sister just like they would my dad. Otherwise, they wouldn't be in the lineup for us anyway. And so I really admire my sister for that. I admire my dad for that too. You know, a lot of people were surprised to see a woman want to come along, take over the farm, and he was always overjoyed for it.
Lori in Madison, we'll go to you now. Hi, Lori.
Hi. Yeah, thanks for the last caller. I grew up on a farm in southern Wisconsin. My grandmother came over on a ship, as did other people in the family. And I guess I just wanted to say the same. It sounds like we're lamenting change, and I feel like remember there wasn't a lot of good things, like, frankly, the isolation and the harm and the hard roles that many people had on a farm. But when my farm in the family, my parents, my dad died in a farm accident. When my mom sold it to another farmer, she tried to keep it with a farmer who, you know, she gave a good deal to and sold it on a land contract. I grew up doing the learning about this, but I hated seeing the farm deteriorate. So what I did is when my mom passed away, I bought other land and I kept it in Wisconsin just for renting to another farmer, trying to keep it just in a way that it is there for the animals and maybe for farmers. I don't want to lament the change. I want to remember the good things, which it was amazing growing up outdoors and on the land, but the sexism and other challenges were real, and I do not want to go back to those.
Yeah.
There's no question about it, and thank you for what you've done for farmland in your area, and I'm so sorry to hear about your dad in that accident. That's a hard thing. We had friends and family who were injured and killed in accidents over the years as well, and we told some of those stories in the book, and they are tragedies, and there's a real human cost to how hard of a life it is farming. I also think that you're right to recognize the beauty of it. And, you know, I think about my family and what we've been through, and I think about what our farm families have been through. And what I hope to do is have a conversation where we can begin to reject a little bit of the false choice between leaving behind this beautiful way of life and having to confront such difficult circumstances. We're in a modern world where we can have some of this way of life continue and also have it be modern and have it recognize the contributions of everybody and have it advanced enough that people don't have to be in quite as perilous of situations. But there's no question that the danger of the way of life and the beauty of the way of life, they sometimes go hand in hand. And we tried to be honest about that in the book. I give my family a lot of credit because as a writer, I wanted to tell an honest story, but I could not have done that if they hadn't. And where we got to, and my dad said it best, you know, he said, well, we want to tell an honest story. And what we realized is that if we want people to understand the importance of this issue and be with us for our triumphs, they got to be there with us for our challenges too, to understand the full picture. And so I'm just grateful that my family was willing to do that with me.
Yeah, absolutely. As you were talking, I was thinking about my Uncle Bob, who lost both his arms in a corn picker and continued to farm for another 30-some years.
That is something.
With hooks. Anytime somebody in the Stoughton Hospital lost a finger or an arm, they'd call Bob. And Bob would go and meet with them while they were in the hospital and have
them. Oh. That's incredible. What a beautiful thing for him to do. You know, you know this from the book, but I had a great uncle named Herman who, as a boy, lost his leg in the fields, and it was a tragedy. And one of the stories we tell, he grew up to be a successful farmer and businessman, and he did that on a prosthetic leg. He got his hand years later caught in a corn picker, and he didn't have fingers on one hand. And I remember sitting there with my grandpa, and him and grandpa would be drinking beer, and he'd pull his pant leg up and show me his prosthetic leg, and he'd show me his hand without any finger. He'd just laugh, and it was the craziest thing to me. And it just shows you the heart harshness of the life, but the resilience of people too. And that's an amazing thing, just like your Uncle Bob.
So if in a new world here, looking at what we should be doing with agriculture and with farming, I want to spend at least a couple of minutes here as we're getting closer to the top of the hour to talk about your ideas, because I thought you had like five ideas that I thought were really interesting and good.
Well, thank you, Larry. You know, they grew out of the history as we looked, and I saw spots where things went differently than we might have had them go if we'd had hindsight being 2020. And so there's a number of things we can do where I think we can reject some false choices. The first thing we can do is we need to start a research and development revolution in this country. Research and development spending by the federal government is at its lowest level since the 1970s. We need to have that come back so that we can have more innovation going into not only farming, but all industries, but farming especially, discoveries that can lead to new types of innovation, like when they figured out hybrid corn and how to grow corn in more places, more resilient. We can have new discoveries, and we can make sure that that technology is what's called scale neutral. And that means that not only large farmers, but medium and small, they can all adopt it. We lost sight of that in the 20th century. And we had many farms that were just as efficient, just as hardworking, just as smart, but they didn't have as much technological innovation coming to them that would work, that was practical for them. So they were left behind needlessly. That's not about, you know, one farm being better than the other. That's about some farms just not having access to the technology. So that's one big thing. We can also make sure that our government policies are geared around how do we create new opportunities for our farmers? Not necessarily more government spending. There's a lot of subsidies that some people do and don't like. But, you know, making sure, for instance, with our trade policies, as we pursue more markets abroad, that can be a good thing for farmers. But if we don't protect them from unfair practices, it can be bad. Good example is blueberries and asparagus. They grow in Michigan. And other countries won't allow you to sell crops like that into their country during their prime season. They say, well, we're selling our blueberries and asparagus right now. America doesn't do that. We still import blueberries and asparagus all year round, whether it undercuts our farmer or not. You know, that's not about debating protectionism or not. That's about saying, hey, the standards that the other countries have for making sure that their growers can sell their products during their prime season, we ought to do that too. So seasonal things like that, all kinds of stuff we can do. And then I think there's a lot of room for us to focus around what can we do as individuals. In Wisconsin, we have the Master Cheesemaker Program, where when we got overtaken for milk production by California, we said, well, we're going to be still among the top in milk production. We'd be the best at cheese production. And we have all these small cheesemakers across the state making specialty cheeses. That fuels our specialty food market. It also is more places for our farmers to sell their milk. That's part of the reason you still have some of those small farms holding on.
Yeah.
And so we can do those things. And if consumers want to meet all that opportunity with saying, I care about where my food comes from, it can really change things. If there's more innovation, government policy isn't standing in the way of the family farm, and we have industries organizing themselves around specialty food, and the consumers want it, we can really make a big change.
Lots of good things. And in terms of and get out and vote and support and work for those who are like-minded.
Yeah, I'll tell you, you know, talk to Democrats and Republicans alike and ask them if someone's coming to knock on your door or walking by in a parade or speaking at a local Rotary, ask them, what are you doing to create new opportunity for our farmers? Not just do you support our farmers, because everyone's going to say, you betcha, right? But, you know, what are you doing to create new opportunity for our farmers? And you'll get a more thoughtful answer. And if we're doing that and we're electing officials in both parties, because it took both parties over the decades, I saw things by both parties. It took both parties and everybody in between to screw this up, and it's going to take both parties and everybody in between to help fix it.
And I see in a Wisconsin State Journal article this morning that Sauk County has voted for the winning person for president the last four elections.
Well, that doesn't give me any special knowledge. I want to be clear. I don't know where it's going to go. But, you know, in Sauk County, you know, there's a lot of counties like that in Wisconsin. Wisconsin's the most important battleground state in the country. Yeah. And Sauk County and a number of these other counties really do tend to be bellwethers. And, you know, I don't know why that is necessarily. It's just the right mix of common sense. Maybe that's what my family would tell me I should say, you know. So,
Brian, been a great pleasure. Thank you so much for writing the book and for being with us today. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Larry. I really appreciate it.
Brian Risinger, his book, get a copy, take a look. Land Rich, Cash Poor, My Family's Hope and the Untold History of the Disappearing American Farmer. Is really a fascinating Reed, and I was glad to have him with us today. Always glad to have our whole team of people, Clara Neipert, Joel Patnod, our producers today, our technical directors, Lee Rayburn and Jeff Robbins, and Jill Nadeau, our executive producer. I'm Larry Mueller, and stay with us. Lots in store.